This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or perhaps how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things it's pretty hard to imagine for the sake of our country, for the sake of our freedom, that freedom that we so easily take for granted. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us. We want to honor their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, entertained, and even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in San Jose, California, talking to 91-year-old World War II veteran Paul Ferdinandsson. Originally from the Fresno area, he served in the 84th Infantry Division during World War II, and you talk about some close calls. Boy, are we going to hear some stories today. But let's go back to the early days. Your folks were Danish immigrants, huh?
Yes.
What was that like growing up in the Central Valley in a Danish-American home?
We went to the Danish Lutheran Church, which was all, there's a lot of Danes around then, still is probably. We spoke only Danish at home. Our friends were all Danish. When I started grammar school at Fowler Elementary, I couldn't speak English.
Wow.
But, I learned pretty fast.
Do you still remember any of that Danish you learned growing up?
I remember virtually none of it now. I could say a few words, you know, but I don't even know any swear words, I don't think, anymore.
Well, maybe that's a good thing, because I wouldn't know the difference anyway, and we might be in some trouble if someone listens to this on the internet in Denmark. That's a pretty rural area at the time, outside of Fresno.
Right. We lived on Peach Avenue. I went to five different elementary schools growing up.
Why so many?
Because my dad's quite poor. He would buy and lose it or just work for a percentage of the crops. So I went to Fowler Elementary twice, Oleander twice, and Bowles for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the moving around. And then when I started high school, my dad had bought a farm, and we were able to stick with it, had a house built on it, and that's where we were from there on, and that's where I went to Washington Union.
And you were a pretty good athlete for the Panthers of Washington Union High?
I was a good athlete, yes, but not necessarily great. But
you went on from there. You graduated in 1940, went on to what was then?
Radley Junior College for 2 years.
Yeah, and if I'm doing the math, it would have been during this time that the world changed a little bit on you. Do you remember where you were and how you found out about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, there was a few of the fellas that I went to school with. We liked to play poker, and we were at this fellas' place. It was in the evening, and then it came on the radio. We were had the radio on. They attack on Pearl Harbor. We all said, well, we're going to be in the Army soon. And they were right.
Yes, they were. But before that happened, you had accepted a track scholarship to San Jose State?
Yes, for javelin.
For javelin. How'd you get involved in the javelin?
It was in junior college, and there was a javelin, and then I just picked it up and threw it a little bit and got interested in it. And so I started to throw it competitively. Bud Winters was the track coach here in San Jose, who's world famous, supposed to be the speed king guru.
Yeah, you're actually one of the few folks. There's a very fierce rivalry out here on the West Coast between Fresno State and San Jose State, and you're both a Spartan and a Bulldog.
Yeah.
That's not easy to pull off, but we'll get to that chapter of the story later. Yeah. Your javelin career at San Jose State was rudely interrupted by Uncle Sam, who had another weapon in mind for you, I suppose.
Well, let's see. I was at San Jose State just for maybe 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
When I got my draft notice, I just hit 20.
Do you remember what that felt like? I'm sure you had ambitions, aspirations as a young man.
We were very loyal. A lot of fellas volunteered. I wasn't going to volunteer. I didn't feel bad at all by being drafted. I felt good about it.
You mentioned where you were when the attack on Pearl Harbor happened, and I'm just thinking, and the wheels are turning in my head now since we talk about San Jose State. I've read about, and maybe you're familiar with some of these stories, the San Jose State football team was actually on Oahu when the attack happened.
Right. I taught with some of the fellas that were, Stanger was his name. He was there with San Jose State's football team when that happened. Yeah.
So you're here at San Jose State briefly, drafted on your 20th birthday in October of 1942. I don't know if you can remember this, because now you've lived it all, and some intense months of World War II are in your rearview mirror. But do you remember at all what your expectations were when you got drafted, what you thought the Army was going to be like?
No, I actually, the Army and the way it's situated and organized, it reminded me of a football team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got this esprit de corps, you know, within your company or platoon or squad that you're in, and it really reminded me a lot of football.
Although I don't think you ever had a football practice where you were crawling under barbed wire with live bullets going overhead or
no.
throwing live hand grenades.
No, that wasn't quite it.
But you did experience those in the Army, and I think we should mention that, because some folks today say, what, are you kidding me? They actually were firing live bullets over their heads while they crawled on the ground under barbed wire?
Under barbed wire, and they had wire cutters.
Uh-huh.
And as they're crawling through, they would use their wire cutters and cut the barbed wire so they could get through there easier and faster, which was, I thought, pretty good thinking.
They didn't get caught, huh?
No.
And you're a pretty tall guy, so I imagine for you, with those bullets flying over your head, and this is just training. I mean, you don't want guys dying in training stateside before they even go overseas, but that actually happened in some places.
Yeah, I think I remember crawling through many on my back,
mm-hmm.
because then I'd push the wire up over and took longer, but that was quite an experience.
And you got a feel, too. I mentioned hand grenades, and I bring that up because I think it foreshadows a little bit something we're going to hear about later in your story. In your training, it was extensive enough that you got a feel for the timing of a grenade and how long you might be able to hold it?
Yeah. We threw grenades in practice. Sometimes they were duds, but then we got a chance to throw a live grenade. You'd pull the pin, as long as you hold the handle down, you know, it doesn't start. Then you got about 3 seconds before it'll explode. So you pull the pin to throw it, and I asked the sergeant that was running the drill if it would be okay with him if I pulled the pin and let the handle go. So now I got 3 seconds with that live thing in my hand and throw it. And he said, if you got the guts, go ahead. I didn't have the guts to do it.
Not yet. Give it some time.
But at least I had that experience, you know.
Exactly. And that would be important a little bit later on.
Yeah.
What was it like for you? I know we're glossing over a whole lot of training, and you feel that that training really served you well. But when you finally did go overseas, were you anxious to get over there and see what you would encounter? Or were you?
We were.
Yeah?
Our division was combat ready way before we went over. There were so many casualties taking place in Italy. The Army needed cannon fodder or, you know, a lot of privates. So they stripped our division of privates. The Army had an ASTP program where they drafted kids that had pretty good education and graded high and tests, put them into college. I guess they're going to build an elite group that way. But then when they stripped our division of privates, there weren't enough draftees to fill us back up again. Well, the AST program was discontinued then anyway, and they filled us up with all these college kids.
Yeah, and I've talked to plenty of those guys who were a little disappointed when that happened way.
They would kind of lord it over us a little bit, but then I'd tell them, well, I had more education than you did in college, so they'd shut up.
When you guys did get overseas, were you starting to get the feeling that this is going to be real now, that this counts, this isn't practice, this isn't a game anymore?
Oh, we were combat ready. We actually were mentally and physically ready to go.
What was that first taste of combat? I know you guys came ashore on Omaha Beach.
Yeah. But
quite a ways after it had been secured.
It had been secured, and we had just broken out, and the race was on for the German border.
And where was that first combat experience for you with the 84th Infantry?
Geilenkirchen. A little city just on the border of the Netherlands and Belgium, where Netherlands has that tip that shoots down a ways between the two countries. We were on instant alert. At that time, I was a platoon guide, which is the second in command of the non-commissioned officers. Platoon has 3 squads, and each squad has a squad leader who's a staff sergeant and an assistant squad leader who's a buck sergeant. And then you have the platoon guide and the platoon sergeant. And I was a platoon guide at that time that we went overseas. And we were put on trucks for Belgium. I remember being in Brussels, all the guys piled out of the trucks and urinated in the street, and I always wondered, I wonder what these civilians thought of seeing all that. But anyway, then we marched right next to the German border. That's when another fellow and I, we were on instant alert to go immediately into the front lines. Another sergeant and I, we thought, well, let's just wander around and look around the town a little bit. Got back, role had been taken, we were missing. We got busted to privates right there on the spot. Within hours, we were into Geilenkirchen and firing away through the city and into the Siegfried Line.
And you, personally, you carried an M1?
Yes.
What else did you have at your disposal?
Well, I had a few hand grenades. Mm-hmm. We'd have, you know, little buttonholes in your shirt or jacket, so we would be wearing a couple of 2, 3, 4 hand grenades. Each squad has a BAR, shoots the same ammunition, but has bigger cartridge, and you hold your trigger finger down, and it would just empty, boom, 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 boom. We had a weapons platoon in the company, and they had the machine guns and the mortars.
Mm-hmm.
So you had 3 platoons of infantry and 1 platoon of heavy weapons.
And the Germans had plenty, too. And you got a taste of that pretty early on when the 88 started unloading, huh?
Right. We were going through a minefield that the tank crew wasn't aware of, but we were. And one of the fellas, Roger Garst, he ran up and pounded on a tank and tell him, get out of here, get back up, because you're going through a minefield. And then the tank rolled over one, and Roger got wounded pretty good, and he was out of the war. I had him put up for a medal for doing that, and they awarded him a Silver Star, and he deserved it. He didn't think about should I or should I not. He just did it.
And I've read some of the things that you've written down about your experiences during this time with the 84th Infantry Division. And we're talking scrambling through open fields with Germans firing at you. You guys are firing away. Artillery from both sides sailing overhead.
Artillery and a lot of mortars.
Mm-hmm. It sounds extremely chaotic. And as I imagine myself in your shoes, a little scary. Did you ever find yourself concerned that you might not make it back home to California?
I didn't have that high an opinion of myself as a human being. I don't know why, but no, it didn't bother me at all, really. Of course, when one lands close to me, I can kind of react a little bit. But
and that happened pretty early on, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
We were going through the Siegfried Line. You know, they have all these pillboxes, and you've got these little domes on top of them to deflect artillery and direct cannon fire. We would attack them with tanks. The tanks would roar up close to them and then fire shells into the apertures and flamethrower, and that would usually cause the Germans that are inside the pillbox to surrender. During one of those times, we were moving pretty quickly, and the Germans fired a 88 cannon and hit the pillbox right beside me. It was like a blindside hit in football. I just got up laughing.
So it knocked you to the ground?
Knocked me to the ground and completely obliterated one of the fellas in our platoon. He was completely, there was nothing left of him. The shell got him that good, and got several others. So that was really my first experience with the 88.
Well, I could see how that would get your attention.
It sure did. Now, we figured it was the best gun in the war, was that 88.
Yeah, certainly did more than its fair share of damage. And I know this isn't easy to talk about, but when that happens, you get knocked to the ground, you get up and realize there's another guy, and there's nothing left of him. And that's a guy that you've trained with that you know.
Yeah.
How does that affect you? How do you deal with that?
You obviously feel a little sad, but you get so used to it, you know, it's no big deal.
Do you allow yourself to think that could have been me?
Yeah. But I wasn't, like I say, I was kind of unusual kind of a person in that way. It didn't bother me a heck of a lot. I was lucky.
Did you always believe you were going to come home?
Yeah, I did.
Why?
I'm alive. Till they get me, I'll still be alive and kicking.
Was that just a self-confident thing? Did it have anything to do with American pride, your faith, anything that really strengthened that resolve for you?
I think I was just born to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really bother me. Well, I all of us did. We kind of prayed for a wound that would not kill us or lose a limb or anything, but that they would be evacuated to a hospital and we're through with combat.
That million-dollar wound,
that call a million-dollar wound. Everybody would be happy to have one of those.
That never happened for you, but you did see some guys who tried to create that scenario for themselves, huh?
Yeah, well.
Inflict the wound themselves?
Yeah, we had a guy in our platoon shoot himself in the foot, and he got out. We just called it an accident so that they wouldn't court-martial him. So this was fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
Guys would shoot themselves in the flesh of their leg and get out.
Well, you never did that, although the Germans almost did it for you. We're going to zero in on some of those close calls with 91-year-old Paul Ferdinandson of San Jose, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest, Paul Ferdinandson of San Jose, California, 91 years old, but I've got to be honest, I wouldn't want to go toe-to-toe with this wiry veteran of World War II. He served with the 84th Infantry Division in Europe. We're going to hear about the Battle of the Bulge and what he was up to around Christmas time in 1944. But Thanksgiving that year was pretty unforgettable, too. You were right along the Siegfried Line near Muhlendorf, Germany?
When we made that attack, it was pretty stupid. And in one of the history books, this is alluded to. It doesn't mention our company or platoon by itself, but the wording, we know it's our company. There at our battalion headquarters, there was a historian from the 9th Army. They go around, you know, and taking notes and stuff like that, and then they write a, turns out to be a book about the Army or the division or something. He was there when this happened on Thanksgiving Day. He said, this is one of the stupidest things I can believe, that they would order virtually defenseless soldiers to attack pillboxes on a town with no tanks because it was mud. We were just up to our ankles practically.
And all you guys had were rifles.
All we had was rifles.
But they're dug in with pillboxes, some machine guns.
Yeah.
They're defended, and you were going to go straight at them.
Straight at them. From the pillboxes that we had captured, there was a small town called Muhlendorf. It was out there 200-300 yards, I think. And on the left side of the railroad track, there was two pillboxes, and on the right side, there was one. Well, our platoon was to take the left one, and we got the order to go. And our captain refused to give the order. He said, this is too stupid to do this.
He didn't want you guys to all get killed.
No. He thought it was an impossible. We couldn't have tanks because tanks couldn't move in that mud. It was just walking, sloshing through the mud right at it. And that's when a machine gun bullet or it could have been a rifle bullet went through it. My pants leg, but on we went.
And you got to those pillboxes.
We got to the pillboxes, and why the Germans weren't there, they could have destroyed us. But my thinking about the situation later was that they thought that there was going to be a larger group behind us, which was actually, it was planned that K Company, once we had taken the pillboxes, we were to signal with a smoke bullet that we've got it secured, and then K Company was going to come through us and take the city or the small village of Muhlendorf. But we got to the first pillbox, and the Germans weren't there, which we were very lucky. I took the lead out in front because I preferred to be there. I don't know why, but I would rather be in front than following, mainly because I felt they would go too slow. Another fellow and I, we slid down into that big dugout that is alongside the pillboxes so you could get into an entrance to the pillbox, which is below ground level.
And you say you got lucky there was no one in it. And
yeah.
That wasn't a guess or an educated estimate. That was just plain a crapshoot, wasn't it?
It was a play because I went up to the entrance and hollered to surrender and threw a hand grenade into the interior. Never any sound. And we went in a little bit and saw it was vacant.
So there are a lot of things working together here. A, the Germans didn't believe you guys were dumb enough to come that way. They thought if you came, you'd have to come on the other side. So that's where their defenses were geared. So you sneak up on them. You happen to choose the pillbox that's unoccupied. So then that gives you a strong protected position to continue attacking the Germans from. Do I have that right?
Yes. K Company, Wilson would come through, I think it was 15 minutes after we got there. They were timed to do that. Well, we got there, and on the town side of the pillbox, I'd never seen that before, but there was a ground-level room that was about 4 foot wide and about 6-7 feet long, and there was three apertures facing the town. There was a river to our left, and if anybody came down the river and circled around, the Germans could fight from those apertures as well.
So then you're in there, but there's still a battle raging on.
Germans would continue to fire mortar shells at us, and so we were very careful. Most of the guys were inside, and I know we had only one or two outside in the dugout, waiting, looking for K Company to appear. There we were. K Company never shows up. And we were supposed to get the second pillbox. Well, we only had maybe a spare 12, 13 men to go after it. Then we had been in that area now for hour and a half, 2 hours. K Company never showed up. So I talked to our sergeant, said, K Company's not showing up. Why should we even bother trying to take that other pillbox? Let's get the hell back. We're just stuck out. Oh, what had happened? The Germans had pulled up a 88 tank evidently in the town and started shooting at that room, which was reinforced with about 10 inches a foot of reinforced concrete. And the Germans started firing, and it started to blow the thing up. And if a shell had entered one of those apertures, well, that would have wiped everybody out.
You wouldn't be sitting here right now.
No, no. That's when I went and talked to our sergeant who had been wounded. But I said, why don't we, let's go back. There's no point in it. We have our strength was facing the town with those apertures, and we've lost that. Let's go back. So he agreed to me. He thought that made sense. So it was getting dark, and we sent one person at a time back and carrying the wounded first. And I was the last one to leave. I just sit on the safe side of the pillbox and just shoot my rifle into town just to make believe at least we're doing something.
Now, wasn't it in that pillbox also, though, that your hand grenade training and experience came into play?
Yeah, and I skipped across that. I think there was a guy at each aperture with a rifle. I was standing in the doorway to get in there. The guys at the aperture said, they're coming, they're coming. There was about 15 Germans with dark uniforms, we figured they were figure special unit, rushed us. There was a barn on the edge of town, and it had only taken them about 8-10 seconds to get to the pillbox, and there was no activity that we were showing, so they thought maybe we were not paying any attention anymore. So they rushed. Our soldiers were shooting at them and killed two, three of them. The rest of them got to the edge of the pillbox. And when that happened, a soldier that was standing by me at the doorway whispered, there's a German just right opposite you. Without even thinking, I just grabbed a hand grenade, pulled the pin, let the handle fly off. Now I had 3 seconds for that thing. And I counted 1,000, 1,002, and reached around and flipped it up in the air. That spooked the Germans. They could figure out what the hell happened. And then they sprinted back. I always wondered for a long time, why did I do that? That whole episode from the time they came to the pillbox till I threw the hand grenade, everything didn't last more than about 15, 20 seconds. It was all over that fast. I'd wondered for years, how do I have the guts to do that? But then I read an article in a Time magazine when it was talking about how people can do things like that. In our case, in the military, it was training.
Mm-hmm.
That time I had spent throwing a live hand grenade came into play. But for me to do that, well, it was a perfect thing to do.
Well, yeah, it saved your life.
Well, it saved all our, because the Germans that had gotten to the pillbox, if they had tossed hand grenades in right away, it would have been over.
Yeah, they missed their opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. It was just our luck.
So you reach around and you flip that hand grenade up, and it kills the German there and scares the rest of them away. So it saves all your lives.
Yeah.
And I go back to the training when the guy said, well, if you have the guts, and you said you didn't have the guts.
Yeah.
This time in the heat of the moment, you had the guts.
Didn't even think about it. It was just reflex action.
And explain to everybody listening why you held on to it so long, because that's a major point here.
Oh, that's true. Well, that if I reached around and flipped it, he had maybe 3 seconds to pick it up and throw it away or kick it away or
throw it back at you.
Or throw it back at us. That's why I held it.
So in all your years after the war of coaching, did you ever play hot potato with your athletes?
No. I don't think, never.
You're there in that pillbox, you're playing a high-stakes game of hot potato.
Yeah, I sure was.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it killed that soldier till now. We brought more people out from in the pillbox, even though it was pouring rain and mud, set them around the edges. Then one guy went over and looked where I'd thrown it, and the German was dead there. So that's how I knew it killed him.
Well, I know all the rest of those guys in that pillbox were thankful that you acted the way you did in that moment. So you guys survived that. So I'm keeping score here. You've had an 88 shell knock you off your feet. You've had a bullet through your pants leg. You've had that close call at the pillbox. I think you also had a bullet that you actually felt touch your nose at some point,
too.
Oh,
yeah, that happened at the pillbox that we had just taken.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think from the angle, it was one of our soldiers.
And that happens,
I didn't
too.
Know. And yeah. I felt the bullet just touch my nose, and I said a bunch of bad words and ducked down.
Yeah, and literally dodged another bullet. And you say it was one of yours. You did see friendly fire take American lives, some of your guys killed by Allied artillery fire. Mm-hmm. And you keep trudging along, and this winter is coming on in Europe. And of course, everyone knows the Battle of the Bulge famously was the worst winter that continent had seen in forever.
Yeah,
and you experienced almost all of the Battle of the Bulge. You guys were sent in just a couple days after it started, I believe.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. When we pulled back on Thanksgiving, we reorganized in Geilenkirchen and were moved to another sector. The war was, at that point, was just kind of stagnant. The Germans made that attack in the Bulge, and we were down there before the Germans ever got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story in itself, really, because this happened right at Christmas time. But it was a miracle. They get word, they've lined up trucks behind a few miles, and we were another new unit over from the United States filled our foxholes. We were pulled back, got into those trucks, were instructed what to do in case German planes attacked us, and that was our entrance into the Battle of the Bulge. We were deployed to stop their advance on the 19th, which was pretty wonderful how quickly our military reacted to it.
Even if you were one of the guys who might have to pay with it.
Oh, yeah.
Pay for it with your life, and you came close a few more times.
Yeah.
And there were some more harrowing moments that you've recounted about those days, and some of them involve seeing some of your buddies wounded, and you even got to the point where you put your life on the line to try to save his, evacuating a wounded buddy with guns firing at you.
That was 26th of December. We'd made the attack on the 24th.
Hard to forget that Christmas, huh?
Yeah.
Do you find yourself every Christmas thinking back to those
days?
Oh,
yeah. A lot of times at night, I wake up 2-3 o'clock, and I'm awake for about several hours almost every night, and much of that time is spent reliving those experiences.
70 years later, you're still dealing with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I got that real bad right at the end. I'd always led all the attacks, and I felt that was my job, and I did it. But right there towards the end, the rumors spread that our division was going to be sent back and then going to be in on the invasion of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I tell you, in the evenings, I'd go out there and the tears would just roll down my cheeks.
Wow.
Because I didn't know if I could lead anymore. I felt I might just go to pieces.
Well, it takes a toll, huh? And you'd seen other guys go to pieces, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And tell me about the circumstance. I believe it was a fellow soldier named Hank who had been wounded pretty badly on his backside.
Oh, yeah, on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
There was a German tank in that small town, Verdun. Name of the town is Verdun.
Right.
It's a village, and it's rolling country, and Verdun is kind of on top of one of the rises on the ridge there. We attacked on Christmas Eve again. That was a sniff. I don't know if we should bother leading up to this attack, but it was supposed to take place about 8 o'clock in the evening, but we didn't attack until around 11. There was a three-hour gap because of a big screw-up. Anyway, we went through the town. I'd instructed the squad leaders to go independently through town as fast as they could go, because we were supposed to dig in on the far side, dig foxholes, and then another unit's supposed to come through and take the town, because the Germans had just kicked out Americans who had that town the day before. It's a fairly important strategic place town. We were to take it back. There was a German tank in the main drag, about the only street in town. Hank got shot in the butt. I always claimed that if he didn't have such a big butt, it would have missed him.
Sure, he appreciated that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he always felt I saved his life, but that's not true. I just helped.
I'll tell you what, why don't we let the listeners decide after this break? I'll have you share that story, and we're also going to learn how Paul Ferdinandsen ended up getting a prestigious medal pinned on his chest by England's most famous World War II general. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know I love it when patriotic businesses put their money where their mouth is and find ways to give back to veterans and today's servicemen and women. So when Clint Sorensen, the general manager at Fresno Acura, asked me if I could pass on their big news, all I could say was, sir, yes, sir. Maybe you already knew that locally owned Fresno Acura had a military appreciation offer, but I bet you didn't know that that offer is being doubled between now and June 2nd. Not $750, but $1,500 off a new 2014 or 2015 Acura. From the subcompact luxury sedan to Acura's line of SUVs that redefine affordable luxury. If you're on active duty, in the reserves, or even a military retiree, consider it Fresno Acura's way of saying thank you for serving our country. With the best resale value in the industry, your Acura will have you riding comfortably for a while. And you'll be helping World War II veterans get to their memorial in Washington, D.C., because Fresno Acura has decided to make a generous donation to my favorite project, Central Valley Honor Flight, for every vehicle sold while this special lasts. Now that's what I call supporting all generations of our servicemen and women. Go see my friends at Fresno Acura on Palm, just north of Herndon, and tell them you heard about it on Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 91-year-old Paul Ferdinandsen of San Jose, California, originally from the Fresno area, but at Christmas time in 1944, he was a long way from Raisin Country. He was fighting and freezing in the Battle of the Bulge. We'll get to that story of why one of his friends said Paul saved his life, but let's get the whole picture of your experience as the 84th Infantry Division recaptured Verdun.
The rest of our company was supposed to have taken the town within minutes after we went through and dug in. We'd done our job.
Right.
Now you're supposed to come in and take the town. Well, they never showed up. And I thought, uh-oh, this is Thanksgiving all over again. I sent two guys back to find out what the screw-up was. Well, they never came back. So I asked another fellow.
Waldron Dyer.
Said if he'd go up for a little excitement, him and I were going to try to get through town. We got up. A German soldier shot point blank at us. Could have been more than a few feet away. And we had left our packs and all that stuff behind belts and shot at him. And then we ducked between these two houses. Got up to the street, and the Germans knew we were there somewhere, thought maybe we'd gone into the house, and they were yelling at us to surrender. So we got to the edge of the town, and he asked me, I don't have any bullets left in my rifle. So we decided, well, we better get back. So we sneaked back to the edge of the house and then sprinted to where we had dug our foxhole and a bunch of hedgerows around there. I said, well, this is all screwed up, and I'm going to go back by myself this time. And I snuck the same way, just said to myself, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, go. Because it's scary, you know, because I don't know, the German might be guns pointed at me. But I didn't go. So I did it the second time. I sprinted, probably broke a couple of records of getting across the street to a church yard, and got back, and our company was on the edge of the other edge of town. I asked, well, what happened? He said, well, the captain said, we had too many casualties from our own, which we had walked partially through too.
Artillery?
Our mortars, basically what it was. So we didn't think we had enough men, and I thought to myself, bolt. They had enough guys. They just chose not to go any further. So I went, found out what was going on, went back, and then now we get to Altman. The word comes that we got to get Hank Altman out of here because he's in bad shape. Our aid man, Gibson, we call him Doc, he dug a shallow trench and laid Altman in it. But then he came to me the next evening. It happened on Christmas Day night, that Hank was getting worse and worse. We had to get him evacuated somehow. So I picked two guys to carry rifles, and another guy and I would carry Hank Altman. And so I'd been through the town once before. We got to the same spot and sent the two riflemen sprinting across to that spot that I'd pointed out, told them that they got shot at or shot, that we weren't coming. We would just not try to bother, because carrying somebody is pretty slow.
Yeah.
But they got across, and then carrying Altman, that he had his arms around our neck, and we dragged and moved as fast as we could across that street. And
did anyone fire at you guys while you were dragging them across?
No.
You got them there?
Yeah, no. And the Germans just stayed bottled up, the four of us, and we came back to the platoon. We had two platoons up there. It was a third platoon, us, and fourth platoon. And during that time, there was a two-story house behind the fourth platoon. They could look down into our foxholes a little bit, and they shot through the head two or three guys. And, of course, we got word in a hurry, do something. So I had guys punch their rifles between some hedges and then shoot into that upstairs and intermittently just fire in there. Mm-hmm. And they never shot again then.
And you're painting a picture for us of how chaotic and insane this becomes. And I'm trying to imagine being you. And it's from one thing to the next. It's, well, these guys are taking pot shots at us from up there. We got to take care of that. You're evacuating a wounded buddy and saving his life and getting back to Hank. So you guys get him where he needed to go, and they evacuate him further from there to a field hospital. But at that point, you probably have no idea whether he's going to make it or not, huh?
Mm-mm.
When did you find out?
It had to have been after the war was over. Maybe he got my address and sent a Christmas card or something. But anyway, we made contact, and we kept in close contact. And he passed away a couple of years ago with cancer.
But you got to see him again after the war at a reunion.
Quite a few times, yeah.
What did he tell you?
I saved his life.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, I felt kind of embarrassed by it. I said, I didn't think your life was saved just by getting back to a good field hospital somewhere.
You had a hand in that, and you risked your life to do it.
Yeah, I did that. But.
And the bulge wasn't over on December 26th. You guys had a few more weeks, and the weather wasn't getting any better. How bad were those conditions? What was the worst that you dealt with? And how frustrated were you with the rubber shoe selection?
Yeah, well, that's nothing I could do about it. So my feet were soaking wet.
You were size 11.
Yeah,
but the biggest
24 hours a day.
The biggest rubber shoes they had to go over your boots were size 10.
Size 10.
So you were on your own.
Yeah. So all I had was leather shoes, you know. They got soaking wet, and that's why my feet froze and turned black.
Where'd you guys sleep?
Out in the open in the woods.
In the snow?
In the snow, yeah.
Digging a foxhole in frozen, icy ground.
Sometimes we'd say the hell with it. We wouldn't even bother digging a foxhole. We just get behind a tree, and during that time, I had a kind of a raincoat, or kick snow away, then lay down the raincoat, and then take my soaking wet shoes and socks. I had another pair of socks that I could change, and we wore overcoats. We had to have something, or we'd be freeze to death standing up. And then lay down on that, and just sheer exhaustion, you'd fall sound asleep for a short while, and then you have to get up and stomp your feet again. And I would sleep with my soaking wet shoes on my belly as I'd kind of curl around the shoes and kind of get them to dry out a little bit.
So day after day of combat during the day and fighting the elements overnight.
Overnight. We were supposed to have scouts out because the Germans might attack us during the night. That's when I took it upon myself to ignore that. I said, they're not going to be going out here in this crap. I put a scout out maybe 2 trees away from us, just maybe not more than 20 feet. Okay, you're the scout now, in case anybody says this is where you were put on duty.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody ever checked. Like I said, I led all the attacks. And we basically, just huge skirmish lines, just moved east. The Germans would stop in small villages or certain spots where were easier to defend and take us on for a short while, and then they would take off because we'd bring in mortars and stuff. And the bulge lasted close to a month.
And what a heavy price was paid, and certainly all those who didn't come home, and that number was astronomical, but... You did come home, and you came home with physical and mental and emotional scars. You told us about the nightmares that you've had for 70 years since then.
Yeah.
How bad did your feet get? Can you give us a sense of what that was like then and what you've had to live with since?
Well, I was in the field hospital right at the end of the bulge, and I could have played that game, and I would never have had to go back.
Because your feet were black. They were frozen, frostbitten, no feeling.
No, they hurt.
You could feel the pain.
Very painful. Kind of a little sideline there. The general of our division came by that little field hospital, and he stopped and asked me, how are you feeling, son? Or I think he called me son. And I said, I'm doing just fine, sir. And tears, I mean, I got tears in my eye. He got tears in his eyes and said, I don't know how you boys can stand it. I was there, I think, 3 days. Then I got survivor's guilt. I felt real guilty that I'm back here on my butt on a canvas stretcher, and they're out there in those dang snow and still fighting against the Germans. So I asked, how about letting me go and going back? If you want to go, go ahead. So I went right back, finished out the war, which ended for us on the Elbe River. We're about 35 miles from Berlin, where we met with the Russians. Actually, this is getting way ahead of everything. I think the American armies could have walked into Berlin and taken it. The Germans would have been very happy because the Russians were just pouring in on them from the east.
They didn't want the Russians taking everything
over. They knew what was going to happen if the Russians took over.
Yeah.
Because they had treated the Russians pretty brutally when they were invading Russia.
Yep.
And they knew they were going to get the same medicine.
I keep harping on your feet, and you would get the Purple Heart because of what happened to your feet throughout those brutal conditions of the bulge. What about in all the years since? Do they bother you? Do you have lingering effects of that?
Yes, I really believe that my feet have given me a little problem ever since. I mean, they all ache, and especially my big toe. It bothered some, but not to the point where I feel I'm crippled.
I know I'm jumping way ahead here, but I'm thinking about your coaching career, and I've interviewed some other guys over the years who fought in World War II and went on to be highly successful coaches. And you finished up at Fresno State after the war. We're throwing javelin for Coach Hanner there on the Bulldog track team, and did some coaching up and down the San Joaquin Valley, and now here in the Silicon Valley, the first coach at Cupertino High School. And, I mean, just hundreds of guys who played for you over the years. There's a lot of players who think they have it rough, think you're tough on them. They have things to complain about.
Yeah.
Did you ever use any of your war stories to put that in perspective for them and say they don't know anything?
No, I really didn't. I know I would speak about the experiences in class. I taught health education and Escalon.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, just to break the routine, I'd go into a war story, and once they heard them once or twice, another war story. They'd heard enough.
Well, I know the people that listen to this program can't get enough, and they're probably in awe, as I am, of some of the situations that you endured. And now that you've had the lens of history to look back, to see the bigger picture of everything that was happening in Europe, the magnitude of the Battle of the Bulge, its significance, and the bigger war, knowing how many Americans died, You think about all those close calls you had. How fortunate do you feel that you survived it all?
I'm pretty lucky because I believe Americans lost 15,000 dead in the Bulge. I think that was the figure.
I mean, here you are. You're 91. You still look like you're in really good shape. You obviously speak very well. People can hear how sharp you are. All these years after these incredible experiences in the war, why you? Why do you think it was that you made it through all those moments?
Lucky. Maybe inheritance. I don't know.
Well, I know that your three sons and five grandkids are pretty glad that you made it home, survived the war, and got a chance to meet your wife and have this life.
Yeah, they wouldn't be around if I weren't around.
Amen. Amen. I know we've covered a lot of ground here, and I'm sure there are a lot of other things that we didn't touch on, but I want to make sure that I say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for risking your life in the way you described, and thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything else that you think it's really important people today remember about you and those 16 million other Americans who served?
Not the only thing I can say is that in the last few years, it seems like there's a bigger emphasis on the veterans. Mm-hmm. From World War II and the Korean War and Vietnam. And we're becoming more aware of that, which I think is good because it gives them credit, which they deserve. And but other than that, no, I don't.
Well, I know there's one other thing I have to ask you about because you've got a great picture here. You asked me if I recognized the guy who was pinning a medal on your chest, and the beret gave him away. It's General Montgomery, one of the great famous generals of World War II.
He was the Eisenhower of Britain.
Yes, he was.
He commanded all the forces.
So how was it that he came to pin a medal on you? What'd you do, and where was that? Tell me about it.
Well, I'm not sure exactly. They don't tell you. This is why you're getting this. I can think of two or three things, like Thanksgiving and Christmas, and there were some other things that our platoon led. And we were attached to the British Second Army in the Siegfried Line, and in the Bulge, I believe we were also still attached in a way to the British Second Army as well as American Ninth Army.
So is that picture, was that once the fighting had stopped or that was while things were still going on?
Still going on.
When he gave you that medal, did he say anything to you?
He asked where I was from. I said, California. He said, oh, that's way out west, isn't it? the general from the United States.
Omar Bradley was there too.
Omar Bradley. He stepped back so that they could take the picture without him in it. I wished he had been in it. It meant more to me.
Well, it's a great photograph.
It is a great photograph. It's a good memory thing.
Speaking of memories, when you think back on it all, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
Well, that I came through not being physically crippled or mentally deranged. I had trouble with, what are that four-letter?
PTSD.
PTSD. That was a difficult time, but I fought my way through it. You know, when the war ended in Europe, the word PTSD wasn't even in use yet.
No.
You were just battle weary or you battle fatigue or something like that. And a few days away from it, you'll be okay.
Just get over it.
Yeah. That's about it.
Easier said than done.
That's right. It didn't work out that way.
Have you found anything that helps with it for you?
Time. Time took care of it.
Has it helped at all? Has it been therapeutic for you to write down some of your experiences?
That's a good point. The reason I did this writing was for family. Mm-hmm. I figured, well, you know, someday I'm not going to be here anymore. What I went through and all that stuff, that was some unbelievable experiences. You'll never know anything about it. So I thought, well, it's a kind of a history thing for the family.
Well done, sir.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it.
Well, so am I, and I'm glad you spent this time sharing with us. And I'm sure there are some veterans listening today who went through some similar things, and maybe your story can be an encouragement to them. As we wrap up, I do have something to add to Mr. Ferdinandsen's memoirs. I was hoping I might dig up a few more details on that medal that General Montgomery pinned on him. Turns out it is England's Distinguished Conduct Medal, one of the highest given by the UK. And you heard Mr. Ferdinandsen say they didn't tell him what it was for, but thanks to the magic of the internet and the British National Archives, for just a few British pounds, I was able to download the recommendation for that medal signed by American General Courtney Hodges. And I guess Mr. Ferdinandsen will be hearing this for the first time, as you do too. It was for what he did right around Christmas during the Battle of the Bulge, and I'll read it to you. In the vicinity of Verdun, Belgium, on 25 and 26 December 1944, Staff Sergeant Ferdinandsen, platoon sergeant, distinguished himself by his gallantry and leadership in action against the enemy. When his platoon was cut off from the rest of his company by enemy armored vehicles, Staff Sergeant Ferdinandsen skillfully placed his men into position from which they were able to hold off the Germans. Disregarding personal safety, he made his way through enemy lines to report the situation to his company commander and then returned to his platoon. The following day, when a fierce German attack further endangered his men, he again went through hostile lines and led a support party through heavy fire to relieve the pressure upon his platoon. By his gallantry and leadership, Staff Sergeant Ferdinandsen thwarted a strong enemy attack and prevented the Germans from seizing a vital position. Sounds like a pretty big deal to me. And so now when you look at that picture on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, Monty pinning the medal on his chest, think about the courage that produced it. We're out of time this time, but join us again next time for a special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes and the story of a son's quest for details on the death of the World War II pilot father he never got to meet. It's quite a story, and there may be some further developments to come. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. There were a few more of Paul's stories that didn't quite fit into the time we had on the radio, so here's a little more for you to enjoy since you're catching this podcast online.
Well, this happened, I think it was on the 26th.
Right.
Three German tanks appeared on the, down below us, you know. There's a lot of brush country in there and stuff. And three tanks, German tanks, came into view, and they would paw around, you know, to scare us, you know. And we were scared because we had no means to fight them.
Yeah, what, are you going to take them out with a rifle?
Yeah. Would have been a joke. But then all of a sudden, off to our left, 100 yards or so, and some cannon fire broke out from the forest area. And at those tanks, we had an anti-tank crew back there alongside of us about, close to 7,500 yards, I guess.
And I read your description of this, and I'm just imagining. I mean, the theme music from a Wild West shootout or something. Here you guys are bracing for these tanks to take you out because you can't stop them.
We can't stop them.
And here comes your saving grace. Guys you don't even know are hiding in the woods. Start firing on the tanks.
They had anti-tank guns, you know, cannon. Well, they blew the. They just busted up those tanks and all of us just went into cheering and yelling and screaming. We were so damned happy.
Yeah.
And a couple of the German soldiers that were surviving it down there got out of their tank and were running for it into the brush. And we shot at them like we were going to kill those bastards one way or another. But anyway, so that took care of that pretty good.
Timing is everything, isn't it?
Everything. And then right at the end of this, I'd gone back. No, I guess when we'd hold Hank Oltman back, the captain said there was going to be a group next day. We're going to come in and sweep the town. And I brought that news back. And that felt pretty good. And in my mind, during that night, the Germans had vacated the town. Because when the troops came in and took the town, there was no shooting, no noise, no nothing. Well, if there were German soldiers there, there would have been some kind of shooting or happening. But I felt, even though the publicity says how many hundreds of Germans were captured there, I don't think we captured anybody. It was just a bunch of BS.
You didn't see them anyway.
No, and they had gone down the flank away from where the other direction and then escaped. Mm. They just went around us. But anyway, this was kind of funny. There was a shed down below us, down the hill, just kind of a shed, I guess, for farming equipment or something. And the roof had kind of been blown off with all that artillery. And I said, I'll bet I can throw a hand grenade into that shed. And they said, ah, you can't do it. But they allowed me to get out of my foxhole and get a little bit closer.
Did they know that you'd been a javelin chucker in college?
No. But then I tried to sneak a little closer. They said, well, you're cheating. So I took the hand grenade on, pulled the handle off, and held the handle down so it didn't start ticking. And I threw it, and it sailed right into the shed and exploded. And seconds later, a German soldier jumped out and was running for his dear life. I guess he was there as a scout, you know, kind of keeping an eye on us. And so that was kind of funny.
Not for him.
No, not for him. But
you showed off your throwing prowess, too.
Yeah.